Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, G7 leaders focus on Russia and Ukraine in the second day of talks. Syria's Assad wins the presidential election by a landslide. Pope Francis gets involved in the Middle East peace process.
Fratelli e sorelle.
Brothers and sisters, forgiveness, dialogue, reconciliation.
U.S. lawmakers press for answers on the Bergdahl release, and wearable electronics is the latest in high tech. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Leaders from the group of seven industrialized economies, including U.S. President Barack Obama, are in Brussels for a second day of meetings that have focused on Russia's involvement in Ukraine. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with the president and spoke with us about the talks.
Well, President Obama came to Brussels with the aim of trying to further isolate Russia for its interference in Ukraine. He got some of that on Wednesday after a working dinner. The group issued a communique condemning Russia's what it called its continued unacceptable interference in Ukraine and continuing violations of Ukrainian sovereignty. There was a very firm call on Russia to stop arming separatist groups, stop supporting them, and to continue to pull troops away from its border region with Ukraine. However, the big challenge for President Obama in Brussels is to convince his partners here to apply tougher sanctions, sectoral sanctions that he wants to apply if Russia, in fact, does not stop interfering in Ukraine. That will be a tougher sell for the G7 partners. They have very strong economic ties with Russia. They also want to be able to count on Russia to help with matters such as Syria's chemical disarmament.
There's a lot of talk about sanctions, but is there any talk about going any further than sanctions?
There is no discussion of a military option against Russia at this point. Apparently, as far as they're willing to go, as far as the U.S. administration is willing to go at this point, is to boost non-lethal military aid to Ukraine. That pledge was made on Wednesday at the earlier stop in President Obama's earlier stop in Poland, where he met with Ukraine's president-elect and said that more non-lethal aid in the form of body armor, in the form of night vision goggles and other items like that are on their way.
Now, this all comes when we're just about to mark the 70th anniversary of the Allied D-Day invasion in World War II. Do you have a little preview of what's going to happen on Friday?
Well, the leaders of the Allied nations will be on the beach there in Normandy, marking, as you mentioned, seven decades since that historic day when the liberation of Europe began. Russian President Vladimir Putin will also be there. He will come face-to-face with President Obama. No meeting is scheduled between the two men. However, there are other leaders from Western European countries who will meet with Mr. Putin.
Will we know what is said in those talks with Putin?
We have received no preview of discussions with between other European leaders and President Putin. However, it's widely expected that they will renew calls on Russia to stop interfering in Ukraine, to do more to de-escalate the crisis there.
VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez speaking with us from Brussels. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says Russia's annexation of Crimea and involvement in eastern Ukraine are the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War, and he calls on NATO allies to respond. VOA's Al Pessin in London has details.
Russian-backed militias continue to fight government forces in eastern Ukraine, challenging the country's new government and, according to Secretary Hagel, creating a challenge for the transatlantic alliance.
We must continue to uphold the credibility of this alliance and the credibility of the international order that European security has anchored for seven decades.
Speaking after a NATO defense minister's meeting in Brussels, Hagel said the need for a new security posture will require European allies to spend more, and they should act before the alliance summit in September.
And members should arrive at the summit already taking steps in the right direction.
The NATO meeting also dealt with the changing allied role in Afghanistan. The combat role will end this year, and the alliance is putting together a force to work with U.S. troops to continue supporting Afghan forces and fighting terrorism. But it's not so easy for European countries to agree on defense issues, according to Raoul Ruparel of the Open Europe Research Organization.
The Ukraine crisis has once again highlighted the divisions within Europe, particularly on foreign policy and particularly on any form of intervention in other countries.
That has been NATO's challenge since the fall of the Soviet Union more than 20 years ago. And it's something alliance leaders continue to grapple with after 10 years in Afghanistan, with new and unexpected threats continuing to emerge. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
As we mentioned, Friday marks the 70th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Europe that opened the second front against Nazi Germany during World War II. The seaborne assault, known as D-Day, took place on the beaches of Normandy in northwestern France, June 6, 1944. Keith Huxon is Senior Director of Research and History at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, Louisiana. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Second World War's European theater had more than one turning point. The first came when British Prime Minister Winston Churchill refused to back down and fought alone against Adolf Hitler in 1940. The second, he says, came during the Battle of Stalingrad in 1942 to 1943.
But the truth was, none of the Allies could defeat Nazi Germany on their own. Hitlerite Germany was that strong, and what D-Day was about was the defeat of Hitler's regime. D-Day was the victory we had to win, absolutely had to, if Hitler was going to truly be defeated. Basically, think of it this way. What if D-Day had failed? What if Hitler managed to push the Allies back into the English Channel? We had done several amphibious invasions, and today we tend to think that success on D-Day was a given, an inevitability. That was not so. We had gone into North Africa, we had gone into Sicily, we had gone into Italy twice with amphibious invasions, and almost gotten pushed back in the sea. If that had happened when we went into Normandy, several things, I think, would have resulted. First, let me just point out that it had taken us 2.5 years to be able to mount this operation. If it failed, we would have probably been looking at another 2 years before we could try it again. If that happened, the Soviet Union in those 2 years probably would have made a separate peace with Hitler's Germany. The United States and Great Britain would have seen political support erode. And as a result, a lot of people would have said it's too hard to defeat Hitler. The point here is that Hitler would have survived, and with the survival of his regime, we can say the Holocaust would have seen untold millions more killed, and I think that he would have rebuilt his military forces and attacked again. At some point, he would have made war on the Soviets, the Americans, the British. We would not have escaped that war. And so, the reason it's so important is that D-Day sealed the fate of Hitler's regime, and it's the reason the war in Europe was won 11 months later.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled program to bring you now a special event. President Barack Obama holding a joint press conference with Prime Minister David Cameron of the United Kingdom. They're both speaking from Brussels following a working lunch with the G7 leaders. Let's take you now to President Barack Obama.
Ukraine. Russia continues to have a responsibility to convince them to end their violence, lay down their weapons, and enter into a dialogue with the Ukrainian government. On the other hand, if Russia's provocations continue, it's clear from our discussions here that the G7 nations are ready to impose additional costs on Russia. I also briefed David on the new initiative I announced in Warsaw to bolster the security of our NATO allies, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as our focus on building counterterrorism capabilities across the Middle East and North Africa. David will be hosting the next NATO summit in Wales in September, and I appreciate him updating me on the preparations for that summit. We agree that it's going to be an opportunity for every ally to make sure they're carrying their share and investing in the capabilities our alliance needs for the future. Now, the situation in Ukraine has also highlighted the need for greater energy security. At the G7, we agreed to help Ukraine reduce its energy risks, to include diversifying its supplies. We're going to help countries in Central and Eastern Europe strengthen their energy security as well. And following the review I called for in the United States earlier this year, every G7 country will conduct an energy assessment to identify the possible impact of any potential disruptions and to offer ways we can better prevent disruptions and recover from them more quickly. Related to this, we agreed at the G7 to continue to lead by example in the fight against climate change, which poses a danger to our environment, our economies, and our national security. I made it clear that the United States will continue to do our part. Earlier this week, we took a major step, proposing new standards that for the first time would limit carbon pollution from our existing power plants. It's one of the most ambitious steps that any nation has taken to combat climate change. It would reduce carbon emissions from our electricity sector by 30%. It will help us meet the commitments that we made when I first came into office at Copenhagen, and it will improve our public health. It's also going to be good for our economy by helping to create more clean energy jobs and ultimately lower electricity bills for Americans. So it's the right thing to do. This builds on the steps we've taken over the past 5 years to invest more in renewables like solar and wind, raise fuel standards for our cars and trucks, and make our homes and businesses more energy efficient. And today, we're holding our carbon emissions to levels not seen in nearly 20 years. So we're making important progress, but my action plan for climate change indicates that we've got to keep at it and do more. I know there's a cause that David's also passionate about. We agree that every nation has to do its share. All the major economies, including the G7 and emerging markets like China, need to show leadership as we work on a new global climate agreement. And that includes putting forward, by March of next year, ambitious long-term targets for reducing emissions. So, again, I want to thank Prime Minister Cameron and our fellow leaders for our work here together in Brussels. David, I believe that whenever our two nations stand together, it can lead a world that is more secure and more prosperous and more just, and we'll be reminded of that again tomorrow in Normandy as we mark the 70th anniversary of D-Day. On that day, like so many others, American and British troops stood together and fought valiantly alongside our allies. It didn't just help to win the war, they helped to turn the tide of human history, and are the reason that we can stand here today in a free Europe and with the freedoms our nations enjoy. So theirs is the legacy that our two nations and our great alliance continue to uphold. And I'm grateful to have a fine partner in David in making that happen. Thank you, David.
Thank you, and good afternoon. And I'm delighted to be here with you today, Barack. As we stand together in Europe on the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, we should remind the world of the strength and steadfastness of the bond between the United Kingdom and the United States. 70 years ago, as you just said, our countries stood like two rocks of freedom and democracy in the face of Nazi tyranny. 70 years ago tonight, thousands of young British and American soldiers, with their Canadian and Free French counterparts, were preparing to cross the Channel in the greatest liberation force that the world has ever known. Those young men were united in purpose to restore democracy and freedom to continental Europe, to free by force of arms ancient European nations, and to allow the nations and peoples of Europe to chart their destiny in the world. Thousands of those young men paid the ultimate price, and we honor their memory today and tomorrow. Shortly after D-Day, my own grandfather was wounded and came home. We will never forget what they did and the debt that we owe them for the peace and the freedom that we enjoy on this continent. Today, in a new century, our two democracies continue to stand for and to uphold the same values in the world: democracy, liberty, the rule of law. And day in, day out, our people work together to uphold those values right across the globe. And that approach has been at the heart of what we've discussed here at the G7 and in our bilateral meeting today. We've talked about one of the greatest opportunities we have to turbocharge the global economy by concluding trade deals, including the EU-US deal, which would be the biggest of them all. A transatlantic trade and investment partnership that would create growth and jobs. A deal that could be worth up to £10 billion a year for Britain alone. It would help to secure our long-term economic success and generate a better future for hard-working families back at home. That is why I was so determined to launch those negotiations a year ago in Lochearn. And since then, we've made steady progress, but we've got to keep our eyes on the huge prize on offer and not get bogged down. We also discussed what I believe is the greatest threat that we face, how we counter extremism and the threat that terrorist groups operating elsewhere pose to the safety of our people, both at home and abroad. This year, we will bring our troops home from Afghanistan. They can be proud of what they've achieved over the last decade, denying terrorists a safe haven from which to plot attacks against Britain or the United States. But at the same time as we've reduced the threat from that region, so Al-Qaeda franchises have grown in other parts of the world. Many of these groups are focused on the countries where they operate, but they still pose a risk to our people, our businesses, and our interests. Barack and I share the same view of how we tackle this threat in the fragile regions of the world where terrorist networks seek a foothold. As I've said before, our approach must be tough, patient, intelligent, and based on strong international partnerships. So when it comes to Syria, now the number one destination for jihadists anywhere in the world, we have agreed to intensify our efforts to address the threat of foreign fighters traveling to and from Syria. We'll be introducing new measures in the UK to prosecute those who plan and train for terrorism abroad. And here at the G7, we've agreed to do more to work with Syria's neighbours to strengthen border security and to disrupt the terrorist financing that funds these jihadist training camps. In Libya, we want to help the government as it struggles to overcome the disastrous legacy of Gaddafi's misrule and to build a stable, peaceful, and prosperous future. Barack and I have both recently appointed envoys who will be working together to support efforts to reach a much-needed political settlement. And we are fulfilling our commitment to train the Libyan security forces, with the first tranche of recruits due to begin their training in the UK this month. In Nigeria, we're both committed to supporting the Nigerian government and its neighbours as they confront the scourge of Boko Haram. The kidnap of the Chibok girls was an act of pure evil, and Britain and the United States have provided immediate assistance in the search. In the longer term, we stand ready to provide more practical assistance to help the Nigerians and the region to strengthen their defence and security institutions and to develop the expertise needed to counter these barbaric extremists. And finally, as Barack said, we had an important discussion on Ukraine and relations with Russia. From the outset of this crisis, the G7 nations have stood united, clear in our support for the Ukrainian people and their right to choose their own future, and firm in our message to President Putin that Russia's actions are completely unacceptable and totally at odds with the values of this group of democracies. That is why Russia no longer has a seat at the table here with us. At this summit, we were clear about three things. First, the status quo is unacceptable. The continuing destabilization of eastern Ukraine must stop. Second, there are a set of things that need to happen. President Putin must recognize the legitimate election of President Poroshenko. He must stop arms crossing the border into Ukraine. He must cease Russian support for separatist groups. And third, if these things don't happen, then sectoral sanctions will follow. The next month will be vital in judging if President Putin has taken these steps. And that is what I will urge President Putin to do when I meet him later today. Finally, we discussed the cancer eating away at the world's economic and political systems, corruption. Corruption is the arch enemy of democracy and development. The best way to fight corruption and to drive growth is through what I call the three T's: greater transparency, fair tax systems, and freer trade. That was at the heart of our G8 agenda in Lochearn, and today we agreed to push for more action on fair tax systems, freer trade, and greater transparency, things that are now hardwired into these international gatherings this year and for many years to come. Thank you.
All right. We've got a couple questions from each press delegation. We'll start with Jeff Mason at Reuters. Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. President. You're going to France later this evening. Since you last had French President Hollande visit on a state visit earlier this year, a lot of tensions have arisen in the relationship, including on BNP Paribas. The French say that a potential multi-billion dollar fine on that bank could affect the global economy and could affect trade talks. Do you believe those concerns are valid? And how do you expect to address them with him tonight? And also U.S. concerns about the French selling Mistral warships to Russia. To the Prime Minister, do you feel isolated, sir, among your EU leaders about your position on Jean-Claude Juncker as European Commission President, and who would you like to see get the job? And separately, do you feel any pressure from President Obama about your position on keeping the UK in the EU? Thank you.
First of all, the relationship between the United States and France has never been stronger. On a whole range of issues, we're seeing intense cooperation. And I'm looking forward to seeing President Hollande this evening to talk about a range of issues and continue some of the work that was done here in Brussels. My answer on the banking case is short and simple. The tradition of the United States is that the president does not meddle in prosecutions. We don't call the Attorney General. I do not pick up the phone and tell the Attorney General how to prosecute cases that have been brought. I do not push for settlements of cases that have been brought. Those are decisions that are made by an independent Department of Justice. I've communicated that to President Hollande. This is not a unique position on my part. Perhaps it is a different tradition than exists in other countries, but it is designed to make sure that the rule of law is not in any way impacted by political expediency. And so this will be determined by U.S. attorneys in discussion with the representatives of the bank. And you know, I'll read about it in the newspaper just like everybody else.
He says he's going to confront you about it
tonight. He'll hear the same answer from me tonight as he just heard at this podium. I have expressed some concerns, and I don't think I'm alone in this, about continuing significant defense deals with Russia at a time when they have violated basic international law and the territorial integrity and sovereignty of their neighbors. So President Hollande understands my position. I recognize that this is a big deal. I recognize that the jobs in France are important. I think it would have been preferable to press the pause button. President Hollande so far has made a different decision. And that does not negate the broader cooperation that we've had with France with respect to its willingness to work with us on sanctions to discourage President Putin from engaging in further destabilizing actions and hopefully to encourage him to move in a more constructive direction. We are at a point where Mr. Putin has the chance to get back into a lane of international law. He has a president in Poroshenko who he can negotiate directly with. Having spoken to President Poroshenko this morning, or yesterday morning, it's clear that he recognizes that Ukraine needs to have a good relationship with Russia, but also rightly affirms the right of Ukraine to engage with the rest of the world. And the steps that David outlined earlier and that the G7 unanimously agrees with, which is for Mr. Putin to take seize this moment, recognize Poroshenko is the legitimate leader of Ukraine, cease the support of separatists and the flow of arms, work with Ukraine to engage those in the East during this process of constitutional economic reform. If Mr. Putin takes those steps, then it is possible for us to begin to rebuild trust between Russia and its neighbors and Europe. Should he fail to do so, though, there are going to be additional consequences. And one of the important things that came out of this meeting today was the recognition on the part of all of us that we can't simply allow drift. The mere fact that some of the Russian soldiers have moved back off the border and that Russia is now destabilizing Ukraine through surrogates rather than overtly and explicitly does not mean that we can afford 3 months or 4 months or 6 months of continued violence and conflict in eastern Ukraine. We will have a chance to see what Mr. Putin does over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. And if he remains on the current course, then we've already indicated the kinds of actions that we're prepared to take. All right.
You asked a couple of questions about Europe. It's worth setting the context. We've just had a set of European elections where, to take two countries at random, France and Britain, in France, the Front National, an openly anti-European party, won, and an anti-European party in my country won. And when these things happen, you can stick your head in the sand and wish these results would go away, or you can have a strategy for addressing the concerns of the people that you represent in your country. I have a strategy to represent and understand and reflect those concerns, and that's why I think it's important that we have people running the institutions of Europe who understand the need for change, the need for reform. And I would argue that is a view that is quite widely shared amongst other heads of government and heads of state in the European Union. As for Britain's future, I'm very clear what I want to achieve is to secure Britain's place in a reformed European Union. And I have a strategy for delivering that. It's about renegotiating our position. It's about recovering some important powers. It's about making some significant changes and then putting that decision in a referendum to the British people. But very much recommending that we stay in a reformed European Union. Again, it's a strategy for dealing with an issue which I think if we just walked away from it, we see Britain drift towards the exits, and I don't want that to happen.
Do you feel any pressure from the United States about that?
No, we have good discussions about these issues as we discuss everything else.
Absolutely.
Let's have a question from the BBC.
Ben Robinson, BBC. Mr. President, even if you don't have a meeting scheduled face-to-face with Vladimir Putin yourself, are you going to end up talking with him face-to-face in France? And do you see real possibilities of opening up a path away from crisis by you engaging with him? Mm-hmm. Britain is potentially facing, Mr. President, two major decisions, whether or not Scotland stays part of the United Kingdom and whether the United Kingdom stays a part of the European Union. What do those decisions mean to you and to the people of the United States? Mm-hmm. Prime Minister, you'll be the first leader, I think, after this summit to engage with Vladimir Putin face-to-face. Despite everything you've said, is there something of an olive branch in your hand? After all, Mr. Putin has not actually denounced the electoral process which brought the new president to power in Ukraine. Is there a way out, and is that what you're really going to be exploring with him this evening? And do you accept that Germany may not come to your aid and stop Jean-Claude Juncker becoming Commission President? Will that actually potentially blow your entire strategy off course? You think you may be able to negotiate a brilliant reform of the European Union, but if Jean-Claude Juncker becomes President of the European Commission, will your credibility be so damaged in Britain that people may simply vote to leave the Union? Finally, who are you more afraid of, Angela Merkel or Theresa May?
Great question. Right. Do you want to go? Let me take those. First of all, my meeting with Vladimir Putin, I think it's just important to have this communication about some very important messages about what's happening now is not acceptable, about the changes that need to take place. I think, as the president said, there is an opportunity for diplomacy to play a role and to chart a path, because we've had these elections. The Ukrainian people have chosen a president. He's a capable man, and it's quite possible that he could have a proper relationship with Putin, and there could be a proper relationship between Ukraine and Russia. But change is needed in order for that to happen, and that's the message that I will be delivering this evening. In terms of your other questions, look, on this issue of who runs the European Commission, European institutions, what matters is people who understand the need for change, who understand the need for reform, who realize that if things go on as they have, this union is not going to work for its citizens. And that was the message that I think was loudly received in these European elections. As for who, as you put it, Angela Merkel or Theresa May, look, I'm very fortunate in my life to work with some extremely strong and capable women, of which they are undoubtedly two.
I have no doubt that I'll see Mr. Putin, and he and I have always had a business-like relationship, and it is entirely appropriate that he is there to commemorate D-Day, given the extraordinary